Hey, Halton here for our friends at Unimac. Every one of us is committed to serve and protect. Unimac is committed to us with the most complete laundry solution for the fire service industry. With their virtual NFPA 1851 training now available in collaboration with a leading independent service provider, you can now protect your crew from cancer-causing carcinogens and educate every member of your department on how to properly launder their PPE in compliance with the NFPA 1851 standard. With tailored gear cleaning solutions, easy record keeping, and training all in sync with NFPA 1851, our friends at Unimac deliver the total package. Get the training details at unimac.com/virtual.
Okay, good evening, and welcome to another edition of the First Two Battalion Chiefs. And I was about to say the invisible hand on the fire ground because I'm going to give a little plug for myself. I started doing a podcast. I've done 10 episodes now on Podbean, and it's also on Apple, on Spotify, Pandora, a whole host of other ones now, and it's starting to get a little head of steam. And what it's about, I call it the invisible hand on a fire ground, and the hand is capital, right? Capital H, and the hand being God. I make no bones about it. I feel that, you know, looking back on my career, 35 years in the FDNY, that I've had some situations that in fires that I just can't explain. And Bobby Halton and I have spoken about doing a book on this, and we are doing a book, and we're getting the stories together. So what I'm looking for is I'm looking for people that have stories that they just can't explain, that last-minute mutual that we did, the swap, or, you know, was supposed to not be working, we work, and vice versa, or just whatever, you know, an inner voice, a gut feeling, whatever it is. I really would like to hear about it, and I'd like to bring you on the show because I have quite a bit of stories, and I wrote a book. It's hopefully, God willing, to be out next year called The Parables on the Fire Ground, and it was 30 stories that I did in the book. And in looking in retrospect on some of the stories, at least half of them have some kind of unexplained phenomena. So it's The Invisible Hand on a Fire Ground. You can find it on Podbean. You can find it on Apple Podcasts. It's now on Pandora and a whole bunch of other ones. Excuse me. So that's my first plug. The second plug, I got an unusual request from a kid, and I guess I just took a liking to him. And he asked me, and I generally don't even answer my phone, but for some reason, something possessed me to answer the phone, and it was this kid, and I could tell that he was very genuine. And he asked me for a fire patch, you know, for my company. And I get these requests all the time. I get them on emails, I get them on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and I don't know how he got my number, but he called me, and I was kind enough. I spoke to him, and I said, yeah, sure, you know, let's see what we can do. So if anybody is listening and they have a patch that they want to donate to this fine young man, just I'll give you my address. It's 23 Coventry Circle, Mayapack, New York, 10541, and I'll post it again, but 23 Coventry, C-O-V-E-N-T-R-Y Circle, Mahopac, New York, 10541. And I was hoping to collect a whole bunch of patches, and when I get them, I'll just forward them on to this young guy. So that's where we're at now. That was just my two plugs. And tonight I'm doing something different. This was a last-minute thing. I wasn't really supposed to be – well, I guess I was scheduled to be on, but I wasn't aware of it. I'm not the most tech-savvy guy. My keeping track of things is not a Google calendar. It's a FDNY calendar that I've been using for the last 35 years. And I write it on the calendar, and I must have wrote it and forgot about it. So Peter Fraquillo called me early, and he says, you know, you're on tonight. And I was like, oh, boy. You know, so I said, no problem. Let's try something different. So I'm pretty aware that we don't get many live callers or live listeners or whatever. But I wanted to try something different tonight where, you know, I want to get people just to call in and share whatever they want to share, and we'll talk about it. And if you'd like to call in, I'd really like to talk to you, because I really don't have much on the plan today. So the number is 760-454-8852. And if you'd like to call, 760-454-8852, and talk about anything fire-related or whatever you want to talk about, it's fine. Because I was going to do something where it involved some people, but it was just too late in the day to start calling people and ask them to come on the show. So I do have someone scheduled, I believe, at 8 o'clock, one of my good buddies from 17 Truck, and he's going to join me. He was one of my guests on my own podcast. It was called The Christmas Story, which was a phenomenal story, and he and I will talk about it. So I won't talk about it right now, but what I'm going to do in the interim, I have a few things to talk about. And I haven't done this in a while. I usually, you know, for the last few years, I've always had guests. And I remember when I first started doing this, I was always just doing it by myself, you know. And now I've gotten to the point now where I usually bring on like Frank Lieb or Chuck Downey or Steve Schaefer from Tommy Burke from Boston. But it was just too late to try to get this together. So I figured tonight I'll just talk about some things I want to talk about, and then hopefully Billy will call at 8 o'clock when he's free, and we'll have some great conversations. Billy is just besides being a phenomenal fireman, he just is a great storyteller. He's, you know, when I got to 17 Truck, I got there in 1986, and it's a pretty storied firehouse. They call the Green Berets, right? 143rd Street and 3rd Avenue between Willis and 3rd or Alexander. It's right on the, and, you know, in the so-called war years, right, they had two sections, right? They had 17 and 17-2 and 60 engine. Now, the history of the firehouse is like this. The firehouse, the 17 truck was the first truck company in the Bronx. 17 truck and 18 truck. I forget where 18 Truck was, but 18 Truck is now in Manhattan. And I think originally we moved down to like Attorney Street, I think, on the Lower East Side. And now they are on, geez, I can picture the street. It's right by the foot of the Williamsburg Bridge in the Lower East Side. They used to be in with 17 Engine, which closed back in God knows when, in the 90s. And then 15 Engine was on Henry Street. Now 15 Engine is in with 18 Truck and the 4th Battalion, and I just, the street they're on just escapes me right now, but I could picture it on the Lower East Side underneath the Williamsburg Bridge. And they were originally in the South Bronx. So there's two engines, 41 Engine, 42 Engine, 17 Truck and 18 Truck, right? 41 Engine was up on 150th Street between Cortland and Melrose. They closed them in 1988, and they were intending on moving them. Actually, they were going to move them over to Melrose Avenue and put them with 55 truck, and they were going to close 71 engine, right? So the community got involved, and it became a bit of a political, whatever, football or whatever you want to call it. So they closed them in 88, and they reopened them in 1990. in June. I remember the day they opened them as a squad, for all intents and purposes. They called them the Enhanced Engine. And they wound up moving 71 engine and 55 truck down to Melrose Avenue and 155th Street with the 6th Division. The 6th Division used to be up DN19 on Washington Avenue, right? So you had 41 engine, 42 engine. I don't know where 42 engine was, and the two truck companies, 17 and 18. And that was January 1st, 1874. That's when they brought the telegraph system across the High Bridge into the Bronx. That's when the Bronx got their first paid departments. They joined the other firehouses in Manhattan, which was formed, I believe, I want to say in 1865, right? So you could tell numerically, you know, that, you know, engine one, engine two, engine three, you know, and so on. So these were the first two engines and the first two trucks in the South Bronx. And 17 was on 145th Street and 3rd Avenue, a little white building from what I read. And then a few years later, they closed 17 truck in that location and moved them over to 143rd Street in St. Anne's for a few years. And then they moved them to their original firehouse, which is now 341 East 143 Street, I think in 19, I want to say 06. And I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. But anyway, so that's where they've been. 17 truck was there by themselves. 60 engine was down on 137th Street. 83 and 29 was up on 138th and St. Anne's in Cypress. So that was the South Bronx. It was a vibrant neighborhood full of tenements. It was an Irish neighborhood, and it was just loaded with people. I mean, chock full of people between 138th Street and, let's say, 149th Street. That was the original South Bronx, even further down to like 135th Street. So they had those companies, and it was a very, very occupied area. And someone told me, and I don't know if this is true, but it makes kind of sense that the way they spaced the firehouses out was based on how far the horses could run. And there's an iconic picture, or it's like a relief, at the Firefighters Monument on the west side of Manhattan by Riverside Drive. That's the Fireman's Monument. It's 100th Street, I think, in Riverside Drive. And if you ever see that relief, it's a white statue kind of with a relief set inside it. And that's 83 engine, a horse-drawn engine that was cast back in, who knows, the turn of the century, right? So you had all these companies down there in the 14th Battalion. And, you know, fast forward, the neighborhood changed drastically, I guess, in the 60s and the 70s. And the 70s just became off the charts busy. The arson just went through the roof. And, you know, I read a book. I'm a bit of a history buff. And the history behind the war years, right? So it started in 83 and 29 and 16 and 17 and 41 engine. And what I believe happened, right? So New York City kind of brought this on themselves. There was a few forces here at work. And one being that the landlords couldn't get a fair wage for their apartment houses. So they have all these expenses, right? They have oil bills and taxes and et cetera, et cetera. But the city has what they call rent control, right? So they can only raise your rent so much, right? My mom actually lived in a rent control building, right? So we were paying like nothing. I know my first apartment in Woodside, Queens was $200 a month, and it was five rooms. It was a railroad flat. And so in a sense, this is what drew the landlords into desperation. So you couple that with some kind of the Irish maybe moving out, and then backfilled with other people, and then the buildings were getting disrepair, and then, you know, if the city had a rule, if you got burnt out of your apartment, you go on the top of the rolls for a housing project. They built the projects down there in the South Bronx. So then they built Co-op City, and then people kind of vacated the South Bronx, and they went up to Co-op City. So you had all these forces at work which resulted in the fire duty going through the roof, especially with 17 truck, right? So 17 and 17-2 were in the quarters on 143rd Street, and 60 engine joined them. I don't know the year, but I want to say sometime in the maybe the 50s. I know that Rescue 3 was in 17's quarters at some point in the 40s or the 50s, right? So you had the two companies in that firehouse. And it just got progressively busier, right? So, you know, it was just – the old-timers told me when I got there, they said that you could go up and look out the window, and down the block they would be lined up waiting to – you know, they had like three or four sections of 17 truck on any – on 60 engine on any given night. So in that South Bronx, you had the 14th Battalion, which was on 143rd Street. You had the 5-5 Battalion, which was on with 73 and 42 on Prospect and 150th Street. You had 41 engine had two sections. Let's see, 83 and 29 are the only companies that didn't have two sections, but they had the satellite. And I think in 73's quarters it was a squad. I don't remember the number. I think it was squad 4. I'm not sure. Then as you move up the line, you had 85 and 59 in the Tin House on Boston Road, 82 and 31. Then they also had these units called TSUs, Tactical Service Units, or the 4 Above Team. So sometimes they would ride with 7 firefighters, and they had a 4 Above Team. They would have guys that would come in and ride just from 3 to 11. It was just inundated with companies on there. And then you had the 2-7 Battalion was in with 82 and 31. The 2-6 Battalion was over, I don't know where they were at the time. I can't remember where they were. I think they were in with 50 and 19 up on Washington Avenue. Then you had 92 and 44 on Morris Avenue, which, believe it or not, in the war years was not that busy. Right, the most of the bulk of the fire duty was below 149th Street, and it was east. So you had 94 and 48, 82 and 31, 85 and 59. You had 41 engine, which my father-in-law was the captain of 41 engine. The engine had two sections. 27 truck had two sections. I thought 46 engine too had two sections. I can't remember. 45 engine, you know, they were crushing it. They had then they opened 58 truck. They had 59 truck, which was a newer truck. So you had all these companies down there in the South Bronx battling what they call the war years. And the fire duty just, it spread like a wild land fire. You know, it just started in the South Bronx and went right up. And 17 truck was really in the hot seat probably for a good 10 to 15 years. They just got progressively busier. And it's kind of funny because when I got to 17 truck in 86, I was told that, kid, you missed it because you should have been here like 10 years ago. And, of course, I didn't want to hear that, and I was not happy about that, you know. And in retrospect, though, looking back, I mean, we did a good amount of fire duty. I mean, you know, albeit that a lot of them were vacant buildings, some were like, buildings, right? Yeah. And even though they were vacant, there were people living in these buildings, right? So we had to always treat them as if they were occupied, right? So we did a lot of vacant building fires, and eventually, you know, they either tore them down or they renovated them, right? So I went to in 1991, when 41 became the squad. There was a bit of a changeover, and 41 was now going to every fire in the 16th, the 12th, the 17th, the 2-6, the 3rd, the 14th, even parts of the 19th and the 18th battalions, right? So for that, I was there for 4 years, and in that time, that's when crack was really on the rise, you know, and that's when we became extremely busy, just relatively speaking, right? So it's just like a brief history of the South Bronx in the fire duty. And then at some point, I think they closed the 5.5 battalion. I can't remember what year. It was somewhere between, it was before 1990. I know that because then 73 and 42 came into the 14th battalion. They closed the 2.7 battalion, which was in with 46 and 27. They closed the 5th division. They closed the 9th division. They closed the 2.5 battalion, which was in Harlem, over by 91. So, you know, things were quieting down now in the mid-80s. But they were still, compared to today, they were still relatively busy. But, you know, 17 truck, it was just a storied firehouse. I mean, some monumental, you know, historical events have happened in that firehouse. One being that they started the Emerald Society pipe band, 1962. And I worked with a lot of those guys that started that pipe band. They started in the basement. And it seems like when I was in 17 truck, there was always someone that was learning the pipes, right? They had something called a chanter, right? And the chanter is the first step in learning the bagpipes, and then you graduate into the bagpipes. So the house watch was always somebody on the watch playing the pipes, you know. And, you know, it's funny, I'm Irish, right, and I would have loved to play the bagpipes, but I remember listening to a radio show when I was, like, in high school, and it was the Irish radio show called WFUV. It was on Sunday, Kilmaggle. And the fellow that they were interviewing was saying that the bagpipes, it takes 10 years to learn them. And I said, there's no way I'm spending 10 years learning how to play bagpipes. So I never got into that bagpipe then. That's one of my regrets, but that's one of the things that happened at Firehouse. Then they started the Green Berets, right? The Green Berets were the guys would go on St. Patrick's Day to march. And then if they lost their hat, right, which would normally happen on St. Patrick's Day somehow, it has their badge on it, they would lose a day's pay. So instead of wearing the hats, they wore the Green Berets, and if they lost the beret, which they didn't, I still have mine for 35 years, it wasn't a big deal. So that's how really the history of the Green Berets started. And then that started in the 17th truck, and then it became the 14th battalion, then the 6th division, and then all of a sudden everybody started wearing the berets. But if you watch the parade on St. Patrick's Day, you'll see the first group that comes up. They have the banner. It says Engine 60, Ladder 17, Battalion 14, the Green Berets. And that's who initiated those berets. Now, they had a falling out with one of the chiefs of the department back in the, I can't remember when it was, in the 90s or something, or the early 2000s, about the berets. And the chief ordered the berets were no longer going to be worn. So that lasted for a few years. And then when I made battalion chief, myself and another battalion chief, John Rice, who was also a former member of 17 Truck, we asked if we could speak with the chief of the department and the commissioner, and we swore that, you know, we'd be responsible, you know, if they would bring the berets back. And they did, and it's been back now for about 4 or 5 years. So it's nice to see that tradition. One of the guys posted yesterday on Facebook, there's two movies. I don't know which movie this was, but there was a movie called The State of Grace with Sean Penn. It's about the Westies and all that. And there's a scene there that takes place on the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And if you see very, very clearly the Green Berets up front with 17 truck and 60 engine. So that's kind of the history of the Green Berets and the bagpipe band. So anyway, the number is 760-454, and if you want to call, please do. I know that a lot of this gets listened to on a podcast and it's not live, but we were going to try something different tonight, and I'm just waiting really for Billy to call in, because Billy and I have a lot to talk about. But I just figured, you know, we'll talk about 17 truck, but what I wanted to talk about was a firefighter named Harry Hoeing. His name was Harold Hoeing. And Harry was, came onto the FDNY in September 14, 1968, and he was assigned to 60 engine, right? And that was just right about the beginning of the war years, right, 1968. and 60 engine would have been in with 17 truck at this time. And Harry was aggressive, and he actually made his first rescue on June 1st of 1970, which I was all about 9 years old that day because I was my birthday is June 2nd. I just turned 60, by the way. And he made his first rescue on that day. And the thing about Harry, right, and the thing about the firehouse that made it so special, you know, it was like Bull's Firehouse. The doors were always open, you know, and we always were involved with the kids in the community. And Harry was, he was a scholar, right? He taught. He was very community-minded. He was a math student at Hunter College, and he used to tutor the kids in the firehouse, right? So he would, someone told, the captain that gave the speech the other day said that he put them in three groups, you know, like division and multiplication and whatever, square rooting, and have them in groups. And if they did well, he'd buy them ice cream. And, you know, this is the kind of guy that Harry was, right? He just tutored the kids in the neighborhood, right? And from that, he also was involved with Christmas, giving out toys to kids at the Lincoln Hospital down at the time. I think it was on 138th Street. And what they would do was they would, on Christmas, they would get the bucket. I think Harry would dress up as Santa Claus, and they would deliver the toys up into the hospital via the bucket, right? So they got the whole community involved. Everyone on 149th Street would donate toys. They'd go down to the hospital, and they would hand out these toys on Christmas. So this is the kind of guy that Harry was, right? So they had a fire. I guess it was in 1974 or 73, I'm not sure. And he made a really good rescue on Willis Avenue. Him and the captain, Laffey. I think it was, actually it was 1973, right? October 29th. And, you know, he and the captain went in a heavy fire, and they found some kids and the mother, and they brought him out. Harry wound up going to the hospital. He was there for like a day or so, and smoke inhalation, because they didn't wear a mask. They weren't even wearing a mask when I got there. So that was a bit of like the old school, you know. So he makes a rescue, gets a medal on Medal Day the next year, big deal, honor the guys that get the medals, and so on and so forth. So a year later, on 1974, which is a bit of a tragic year, right, because 1974 would have been the 100th anniversary of 17 Truck, right, because they were formed in 1874. But they had a fire on Bergen and 148th Street, which was right below the hub there, right? At the time, I think it was even they had an elevated train on 3rd Avenue. And, you know, Harry brought the roof firefighter up to the roof, and then as he's, you know, to rescue some people that were trapped. It was heavy fire, and if you look at the picture, you could see the heavy fire that was going through the roof. They're rescuing some people, and the bucket got caught on the lip of the cornice on the roof. And as he was trying to, you know, kind of free the bucket, he got catapulted out, and he actually succumbed to his injuries. And which is the remarkable thing about Harry, though, right? So at the same time, there were some firefighters that were severely burned in Queens. They had received some gasoline, and the firefighter on house watch, his name was Al Bold. It was a 294 engine, 143 truck on Jamaica Avenue off Cross Bay. And Al got severely burned, and he was in the burn center, and he needed a donation of skin. And Harry, the next day, you know, got his injuries, and he actually wound up succumbing. But the skin from Harry was donated to Al, and Al survived. So even in death, Harry was still doing great things. So Harry died. The firehouse, June was always like a kind of a busy month for the firehouse. So they had a medal day, and then they also had something that Harry started, which I failed to mention. They used to do a dinner, a full-out Thanksgiving turkey dinner in the firehouse for the senior citizens. And, you know, this was the tradition started. So they had Medal Day, and then they do the dinner for, you know, for the we used to call it the old people's dinner, right? And then the whole neighborhood would turn out, and we did the whole thing. And that tradition carried on even until when I was there. That was the week that you really couldn't do anything because you had Medal Day, in which we were always involved in Medal Day. Someone from 17 Truck was always getting a medal at some point. And then on Saturday, we had the mass to commemorate Harry. Right, so that was all that stuff going on in June. I think that same year they had another fire. It was a fire down at the rail yards, and two firefighters, Johnny Williams and Russ Lindenball, were they were down there. It was a warehouse type thing, and they had a portable ladder up. They were just taken up. And there was a miscommunication with the train master about whether power should stay on or stay off. And they put the power back on. And Johnny Williams and Russ Lindenball were taking the ladder down, and the electricity arced and electrocuted both of them. So in that year, we lost three firefighters from 17 and 17-2. Then there was another firefighter that was killed. He was down in the Caribbean, I think. His name was Neville Martin. And there was a plane crash or fire or something like that. And he was out of the plane, and he went back in to see what he could do and rescue, you know, whoever he could. And he wound up succumbing to his injuries in the plane, right? So that's kind of the history of 17 Truck. You know, it's a very special place. It still is. It's a very storied firehouse. And, I felt like I was blessed that I was assigned there at a probie school. I remember going there at a probie school, and the, you know, people that knew would tell me that, like, oh, you're going to 17 Truck. It's a hard luck firehouse. Because of all the, you know, the four deaths, I should say. But, it was just a great firehouse. And we caught some intense fire duty in that place. And that's all you could say about that place. So it's 8 o'clock. I don't know, maybe Billy's delayed. So if he's going to make his way, I'll be fine. If not, we're going to move on. So June 17th was Father's Day in 2001, right? And that's the day that we had the Father's Day fire. We lost three firefighters. And on one of my podcasts, I'm going to do a culmination of all the interviews that I did on my podcast about, you know, some of the divine intervention that happened that day. But I interviewed four people that were at that fire. One was Brendan Manning. He was a battalion chief. He retired. He was a lieutenant at the time, working in 163 truck. I spoke to Joe Vasilla, who was a fireman in Lattawoodson. I know Joe from the neighborhood, actually. I grew up with Joe. He was in Astoria. I grew up in Woodside. And he was, you know, he was injured very badly at that fire. I spoke to Brian Kearney. Brian was in 117 truck, and he was thrown out of the second floor with Mike Milner from Rescue 4, right? So those four firefighters I spoke to about the fire. That day, so what they call that fire, the Father's Day fire, was called the Forgotten Fire, right? Because it was 3 months before 9/11. And if you ever see the pictures and what happened at that fire, it's just nothing short of a miracle. I mean, we lost three firefighters that day, but we very well could have lost up maybe 30 or 40 firefighters. And I've been researching this, and I've been thinking about this a long time, and I remember that day so vividly because I was working. And I'll tell you what happened. So I forget the time. It was somewhere around noontime, and there was a fire. No, it wasn't a fire. It was a hazmat incident in a supermarket a few blocks from where this Father's Day fire happened. So all the companies that would have been at the Father's Day initially were at this, really turned out to be nothing. Taxpayer, it was a supermarket, some sort of leak that really was nothing. And Squad 288 was there as a hazmat unit. So that's what brought them down. And it really turned out to be nothing. But I was working in Harlem. I was in 58 Engine at the time. And I remember we had a fire over on Lexington in 110th Street. It was a vacant building. It wasn't much going on. It was either fire or some sort of collapse, whatever it was. But it was very quick. You know, we were there for like an hour and whatever. And I remember seeing Squad 41 there. And, you know, I had just left there like in 1995. So I still knew a lot of the guys that were working. And I saw them, and they said, they're calling them a Squad 41, respond to Queens, because 288 was working as an engine, so they went as the squad, right? So they get a call for a fire in a hardware store, right, loaded with chemicals in the basement, chemicals, paint, thinners, lacquers, you name it. You know, and that would have been first due were not assigned on the box. So the first two companies, I think, was 260 engine coming from a big distance and 163 truck. So 163 is coming from, like, my old neighborhood in Woodside to Astoria. That's a hike. The companies that would have been first due would have been 117 and 116, and they were still at that other hazmat incident, right? So I've been thinking about this, and after speaking to Brian and some of the guys, Joe, that, that hazmat incident in itself was a sort of a miracle, because, and even Brendan Manning said the same thing. He says, had those guys gotten there earlier, it would have blew with all of them in it. But since everything was out of sequence and stuff, it was just, it just threw everything out of whack. So, they get this call, and it's a two-story, right? It's a one-story. It's actually two buildings joined into one, and it's the hardware store. It's got the whole basement. They got everything down there, stored. And then in the rear, they had a door that, that Brendan told me it was like the door from hell. They actually, it was bolted into the ground, right? It had these, like, slide bolts that went into the ground. So they actually had to use the Hearst tool to open it, right? So the chief, Billy Seal, extends 163 around the rear. 288's first due. They stretch 1¾ inches, and then the captain, Dennis Murphy, tells them to go back and get the 2½ because it's a taxpayer. And there's heavy fire in the basement. So 288 and 116 now at the top of these interior stairs, right? 163 is around the back. Harry Ford from Rescue 4, John Downing was a chauffeur from 163 truck, and Joe Vasilla were on the Bravo side, the Exposure 2 side, working on the basement windows. Brian Kearney and Mike Milner were on the floor above, on the second floor in the occupancies, venting. He said the smoke wasn't that bad, but they were, there was some smoke coming up. They were taking the windows like gentlemen, right? So this is all going on, and there were guys on the roof, and they were in one spot, and then they moved, a bunch of them moved to the back, and then all of a sudden the building just blew up. Now, the only thing that Brendan remembers is that he was able to get the back door open, and I saw a picture of the door, and he was able to get the back door open just enough so he could squeeze in. And he said he just got a brand new thermal imaging camera. So he was looking, and he said he heard, he thought it was water from the hose lines, but it was just a fire crackling. And the next thing he remembers is he woke up in the hospital. He got blown out, like, out into the rear yard, like 30 feet, and his injuries were just massive. I remember seeing him, I think I visited him at home, like maybe 3 weeks after the fire, and I mean, he was just, I mean, he his eardrums were shot. I mean, he just had stitches everywhere, and he was just blown to bits, you know. Joe Vasilla was working on the windows with Harry and John Downey on the two side, on the Bravo side. And Joe says that he heard a voice that said, it's going to blow, or it's blowing. And instead of looking, he turned his back, and it blew, and he caught the brunt of it. He said he called it like doing a slide. Like he just slid, and then he was buried up to his, like, neck in debris. And Harry and John were now buried totally on the wall. It just, like, half the building was blown out. Like, if you see the pictures of this building, it looks like something out of World War II, like someone was strapped like a bomb on it. Now, while this is going on to the firehouse now, I'm in 58 engine with John Calamari from 26 truck, and we're listening to everything that's going on. And I remember this report. It said a second alarm box, you know, whatever it was, 7-4, whatever it was. They got three lines stretched. Trucks are inside opening up. We got heavy fire in the basement, and the fire is doubtful. I walked out of the room to go to the men's room for a second, and I came back. And John says to me, he says, Danny, he says, the building just blew up. And all I could think about was that there was three engines in there. There was two truck companies, 116 and 117, and the rescue. And there's got to be at least 30 guys involved in this now. I spoke to a guy who was a medic at the time, this guy Tom Bendick. He's now a lieutenant in the fire department. And he said that when they got there, he said it just looked like a war zone. He said there was bodies everywhere. And, you know, you see the funeral for the three firefighters, you know, Harry and John and Brian. And, you know, guys were in wheelchairs and crutches and bandages on the head. So, you know, this was just time. It was, you know, three firefighters dying. It's just unimaginable. You know, that was the first... I think that was maybe the first time. I know we had Vandalia Avenue. We lost three firefighters. You know, so that up until then, I can't remember what year Vandalia Avenue was, but it's just you take it to heart, you know. Like, and you know, I knew John from the old neighborhood. John played basketball. He was from another parish, St. Sebastian's. I was from St. Teresa's, but I knew John. He was a big guy. You know, I was like a little peanut, and he was like this big guy. And, you know, I knew his sister very well. We went to school together, but, you know, I knew John just kind of to say hello. But the one that really hurt was Brian Fahey. Brian, I mean, I just loved him. We always kept in touch, and, you know, we sat he was two people away from me in Proby School. So Brian was on one side, and actually John Ginley, who died on 9/11, was on the other side. But Brian was just, you know, he was just a great guy. I remember I didn't like the helmet that they gave us in Proby School because we were one of the first classes to get new helmets that have the fiberglass and were very heavy. So I remember driving out to Hempstead Turnpike, and that's where Brian lived, and he gave me like a leather old school helmet. I still have it. I'm looking at it right now in my basement. So, you know, Brian and I, you know, we're very close. You know, I saw him one time. I tell you, he started out in 249 engine. Then he went to 155 truck in South Jamaica, the Vipers, right? I think 143rd Street and Rockaway Boulevard. Then from there, he went to 288, squat 288 when they made them a squat, right? And now Brian was also a chief in the volleys, right? So Brian was just totally into the fire department. And he drove me one time. We had a fire in Corona, and we had to get on this highway. And he drove that rig like a sports car, man. And I tell you, I was looking at Brian. I had my feet up on the dashboard, and I'm like, Brian, man, just get us there. Because it was a relief to get to the fire, because it was just getting there was half the battle. But, you know, he thought it was funny, man. He just he whipped that rig around like it was like a race car. And then he went to Rescue 4. And Brian, I guess, was on the inside team of Rescue 4 and then somehow wound up in a basement. And they were talking to him, but they just couldn't get to him. And that broke my heart, man. I just, you know, even though I didn't talk to him all the time, you know, when I saw him, it was just always, you know, like we just saw each other. I had a party when we graduated Proby School, and I just remember Brian being at the party, and it was just so much, it was just so many laughs. He just laughed the whole night. So so it was close. It was close to home, that fire. But, you know, the fire itself was 20 years ago, and it was right before 9/11. And at the time, you know, it was the big deal. But then 9/11 happened, and it was like forgotten. Like they told me, the forgotten fire. So I spoke to Joe Vasilla, and he told me that story about the. Hearing that voice, and he turned around and he just took the brunt of the blast from his back instead of his face. And then I spoke to Brian and Mike Milner, and they were on the floor above. And, you know, Brian told me a story about the lieutenant, and he needed something done. He asked the guys on the roof to check something out, and there's like five of them, and they all were in one spot, and then they walked all of them to the back of the building away from like where the collapse would have been. And then the building blew up. Had they stayed in that spot, they all would have went down the building. So, you know, there's a lot to that fire. And I think, you know, in researching it in retrospect, that the fact that they had that hazmat incident over on, you know, like a few blocks away, probably somehow was instrumental in saving more guys. And, you know, we hear this all the time. About just, you know, people should have been somewhere and they weren't, or something happened, or they, you know, the plans changed, and all of a sudden, you know, that, you know, it changed the whole outcome, right? So it's just, I don't know, it's just, it's really tough to figure out in the fire service, you know, these things, how they happen, because there's no explaining in my mind. I mean, you just try to wrap your head around, like, why we don't get killed more often, for lack of a better word, because it was just it's just an incredibly dangerous job, you know, and how these things sometimes play out is just remarkable. Like, one of the stories that I talked about on my podcast was Kerry Murphy. And I call it, I think it's called, Nothing Shall Deter the Roof Man from Getting the Roof. And that's what I was told in Proby School. You know, that's what the instructors told us. If you have the roof, you get the roof, you know. And that night, we had this job on 138th Street, and we were supposed to be first due, and we had a covering officer, and somehow the message never got to him that we had to run. The engine got it, but, you know, he didn't get it. So I remember running up the stairs to get him. And instead of being first due, we were second due, right? And, you know, being second due, though, sometimes I swear is worse than being first due. But I mean, well, more dangerous, I should say, not worse, but it's more dangerous because we had to go above this thing. And it was, I think the fire was on the third floor. I can't remember. The whole flat was going. It was a railroad flat. And, you know, we went above. And you know, just heavy fire. And, you know, I just, the one thing I remember is that the lieutenant from the first Jeep truck company kept calling this roof firefighter. He says, hey, you know, get the roof. And, like, no answer. Like, he was just trying to make his way. And what happened was that, talk about fate, right? So they were first due, we were second due. It's his first night in the South Bronx. He had come from another area, and he tries going up the front fire escape, and the senior guy at the time was a guy named Bobby Stokes, and he says, where are you going? He says, I'm going up to the roof. He says, not like that. He says, you're not getting the roof because the front fire escape doesn't go to the roof. So he goes around to the Bravo side, on the two side, on Alexander Avenue, and he goes up, and it's just the whole thing, the way it happened. It's just, I still can't wrap my head around it. So he's wearing a mask and an air pack, an SCBA, and he's got all his gear on. And back in those days, myself included, I guess, the roof firefighter didn't really wear anything but a pair of leather boots, no mask, and barely just, you know, maybe some tools in his hand, you know. And he's got his mask on. He gets to the fourth floor, and he's got to put his mask on because it's like it's charged in the exposure because the windows are open, so he needs his mask. He gets up to the roof. He can't see the hand in front of his face, and the bulkhead came out facing the avenue instead of facing the rear, and he got turned around. He started going to the right, and then he did another turnaround, and he had to get over to get the bulkhead, but there was a shaft in between the two buildings. And the shaft is what we call a diamond shaft. And when he was a big guy, he's a tall guy, and he took his tool and probed, and he felt solid flooring on the, you know, on the roofing on the other side. I guess he threw his tool, maybe one tool, because I think he said he still had his halogen in his hand. And the next thing you know, he falls down this hole. All that had the radio was the roof, and the chauffeur and the officer, like I have to say, maybe the OV too had the radio, and we hear this mayday, you know, mayday, mayday. I'm in the hole or I'm in the shaft, and we didn't even know who he was because no one knew his name. And someone from 60 Engine, Bobby Wright, he was a nozzle firefighter, goes to the window, shimmies down a drain pipe three or four stories to get to the basement to get to him. He's there, and I don't know, he hit a, like, it was like a pile of rubbish. It was like a story deep, and like he was just, like his liver was cut in half, like it was hanging by a thread, and he's like bleeding out, and, you know, we got to him, and he survived, you know. But it's amazing because, like, had, I guess, we've been first to our roof firefighter, Jimmy Gilligan, would have had no problems at all. And this other guy probably just would have followed him up and it never would have been an issue. But, you know, it's just one little twist of fate, you know, like, you know, just a little delay where we should have been first due and now we're second due had changed everything. You know, the other thing about that fire that I remember, there were railroad flats, and the unique thing about a railroad flat is that they're shaped like railroad cars, right? So you go in one room, and you go through the other until you get to the front of the building, right? And this building was an oddball, right? Because it had a front fire escape, but it didn't have a rear fire escape. Now, at the time, I was just too stupid to even pay attention or even know what I was, like, sizing up, you know? I go charging up to the floor above, and I go to the rear and thinking, like, well, you know, if things go sour or south, I'll just pop out the fire escape. I get there, there's no fire escape. There's no rear fire escape, right? And now I look back where I just passed, and the fire burns through the floor now, right? So, poof, like I had a dilemma because now I have to get back to the door or else I'm in trouble. And that's when the mayday happened. And it's a bit of a blur, but when the mayday happened, I thought that some guys had fallen through the hole in the floor that was on in the apartment that I was in. You know, I couldn't make heads or tails of who it was, and I didn't have a radio anyway. So all these things happened at that fire, and Kerry wound up surviving. He's still banged up to this day. I mean, he lost his voice and stuff, but I don't know. It's just one of those things where, you know, had we just responded like we normally would have, we would have been first to, and probably this wouldn't have happened. So, you know, it happens. But he survived, which is amazing. They said that he went 75 feet. He was going about, I think, 70 miles an hour, they figured. So, you know, that was just another story that we had. So, well, I guess Billy is not calling. And I was hoping to talk to Billy about some of the things that went on 17 truck. And it has been an hour. So I'm sorry for this kind of unpreparedness. But it was, I wasn't going to call these guys that were involved in a Father's Day fire at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon to try to bring them on. It was just, it wasn't going to work. So maybe that's on me too. I should have, you know, I just got to come up with a better system on figuring out when I'm doing these things. But any last thoughts, 760-454-8852. And that's the number if you want to call and check in and talk about anything you want to talk about. I'll be happy to chat with you about it. So, again, my podcast, I'm gonna self-promote. It's called The Invisible Hand on the Fireground. the book, hopefully coming out soon. I don't know when. Parables from the Fireground. And, you know, just busy. You know, we had the call for papers for FDIC. I'm going to start a new class I'm developing that's based on UL, an article I wrote for a magazine called It's Evolution, Not Revolution. I took a UL boot camp in May of 2019, and there's like 47 points that they came up with that I'm discuss. I'm hoping to do maybe a workshop. I'm also available if anyone is looking for a speaker at their fire department. I don't do this much, but I'm going to start doing it now that I got a little more free time. I have that class. We're going to call it Evolution, Not Revolution. And I have the class that I'm doing in August. It's called Fires in Concealed Spaces. And that's all about the problems that we're having these days with all these, you know, electrical fires that are building in walls and, you know, attic spaces and concealed spaces and breaking out. So, you know, I have a theory on that. My theory is that, you know, with people working home now, everyone's using their computers and there's more and more electricity being used. And I think this wiring were not intended, you know, for this kind of this usage, this electrical load. So fires are smoldering and they're getting some sort of ignition source and some sort of, at some point they're getting some air and then they're breaking out and they're well advanced. So the name of the class at FDIC, I think it's August, it starts August 2nd. I'm not sure when I'm on, but it's going to be Fires in Concealed Spaces. If you'd like that class for your local fire department, I could do that. And I also have this new one that's going to be really good. It's called Evolution, Not Revolution. And there's a lot of stuff that I talk about from when I started in the fire department and all the changes and the fire behavior and the plastics and the equipment that we have, the whole gamut, where we are now. And that should be a really nice class. So I'm looking forward to developing that. It's pretty much done. Now I just got to test drive it. So with that, that's all I got tonight. So I'm exhausted. I had a full day. I'm riding my bike. Last thing I want to promote, I'm riding my bike from Naples, Florida to Ground Zero, World Trade Center. We're coming in on September 11th with 38 first responders. I'm riding for the firefighters that are dying from cancer, the 9/11 related cancers. I had melanoma myself, which we got early, thank God, but lots you know, a good amount of firefighters are dying now. I see it on the orders like every day. I think we're up to 250 last I checked, or 260 now, of firefighters have succumbed to 9/11 cancer. So I'm writing to honor those firefighters and first responders. So if you want to check it out, it's called Brotherhood Ride. It's on Facebook. I think it's brotherhoodride.com. I post it on my social media. Now, if you want to support me, I'm looking for a penny a mile. If you support me, and ironically, it's 1,700 miles, it comes to $17. And we're using that money, and whatever we get donated is going to a charity. I don't know if I can mention it yet, but she's got a great charity, and they work with firefighters that are suffering from things like PTSD and stuff like that. So I'm writing for them, and I'll announce that very shortly as soon as I get the okay. So, again, it's brotherhoodride.com, I believe. If you Google my name and Brotherhood Ride, and like I said, a penny a mile. That's all I'm asking. I'm killing myself. That's why I'm so tired. I've been riding, like, every day, 40 to 50 miles. But I want to do it for let's not forget these guys that are dying still, right? So, just real quick, I remember when I came on the job, you know, you go down to the medical office, and what they would, you know, what they would do is they bring out your folder, right? And if a folder had, I want to say it's a red dot on it, that meant that they were at the phone company fire. And I think every one of those firefighters that was at that fire, because it was PVCs that were burning, and PVCs and PCBs, it was all kinds of cables, you know, that were burning, and they've all died from cancer. And now, all of us that were at 9/11 on the World Trade Center have a dot on all folders, you know, and a lot of them are dying. So I'm writing for them, a penny a mile, and the money's going to go to a very good charity, a very dynamite girl who's doing great work with her charity, with her organization. So with that, thanks for being here tonight. And next time I will have some guests, so you won't have to listen to me. And with that, I'll say good night and be safe.